Well, it's a story that made waves in the world of science this week, gravity waves to be precise. In a discovery, physicists are calling huge, extraordinary and spectacular, a team of observers at the South Pole has found the first direct evidence of the primordial ripples in space-time. And they may give us a direct window into the earliest moments of our universe. It's a groundbreaking story to be sure, but it's also a complex one, and here to explain it, amongst other developments in the world of science, is Chris Smith, joining us from Cambridge. Chris, hello there.
Hello, Fran.
Now, Chris, can we start with this huge scientific story that people are saying is going to be a Nobel Prize-winning story, the detection of these ripples in the universe from the moments just after the Big Bang. Just how important is this discovery, Chris?
Well, as you say, it could be recognised by a Nobel Prize. The team behind it being extremely quiet on that front because obviously they don't want to bang their own drum, but lots of people are banging the drum for them. Why it's important is that it tells us a little bit about what really happened when the universe began 13.8 billion years ago. We know there must have been some kind of Big Bang. We know that there was a point singularity, a tiny point, which was highly energetic, which exploded outwards. But that was very intense, very hot. And that meant that the environment at that time was just a sea of particles and electrons whizzing around in a sort of plasma. And light, nothing could come through that without hitting something else. And that meant that the signals couldn't come from that environment for us to see today until things had cooled down a little bit and condensed into blobs of matter, which then ultimately become galaxies and so on. So in other words, you get this opaque phase in the very early phases of the universe's evolution that we can't see into. But there is a sort of echo of what happened in that early phase in the form of these so-called gravitational waves, which is what scientists have been able to now pick up. The way they did it was they used a previously extremely profound scientific discovery, which was made in 1964 by a couple of scientists, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, and they discovered something called the cosmic microwave background radiation. They thought actually that this was just noise on their antenna. They in fact put it down to pigeon droppings on their antenna because there was this fizzing noise they picked up. And in fact, this is what we now dub the afterglow of the Big Bang. It's radiation which would originally have been extremely intense and short in wavelength, which because the universe has expanded, you've got this radiation being stretched out, and it's now very, very big long waves in the microwave regime, and we know how to find those. And so what this group this week have done is they have built an instrument, and it's called the BICEP 2 instrument. It stands for Background Imaging of Cosmic Extragalactic Polarization 2. They've put it at the South Pole in Antarctica because the air there is extremely cold and therefore extremely dry, and dry air is very good at seeing microwaves because microwaves are normally absorbed by water. And this has enabled them with this instrument to see this cosmic microwave background radiation, and specifically what they're able to see are twists in the waves, so-called polarizations, perpendicular to each other, and that, when you image it, looks in a sort of wavy pattern, and those waves are what we would dub gravitational waves, as predicted by Einstein in 1916 in his theory of general relativity and previously never observed. And so this shows us that that fingerprint of what was going on right early on in the Big Bang is written into that radiation. We can read it and it gives us a window right back to almost the start of time.
And it's because Einstein predicted it that we've been looking for it. I always wonder what makes scientists look for these things. You know, what gives them the idea? Was it Einstein saying this must be there, therefore they've been looking for the proof since then?
Well, there are lots of theories about how things could have worked out back in the very early days of the universe. And there are lots of models, lots of simulations, and they're all informed by hypotheses and some laws of physics. And there are unknowns, and because there are unknowns, including some of Donald Rumsfeld's famous unknown unknowns, we have to make a range of different models and predictions. And then as we gain more knowledge, we refine and revise those predictions, and it narrows the degrees of freedom. Now, Einstein had made these predictions, and we know general relativity works, and so many other aspects of what he said were right, that it seems pretty reasonable. But one likes to have the observation. So people went looking, it fits, and so we're happy to say, well, it looks like Einstein got that one right too.
Gee, he's good, isn't he? 18 to 7 on breakfast. Chrissy, in other news, maybe not quite as ancient as the Big Bang, but 1,500-year-old moss has been found in the ice in Antarctica and been brought back to life in the lab. How is this possible, and what does it tell us?
Well, about a year ago here on RM Breakfast, we reported on scientists bringing back to life a plant that was last growing when Australia hadn't been colonised by anyone from England. It was about 400 years ago. And this was a kind of plant that was growing under or was revealed when ice retreated. And scientists hailed that as a big breakthrough. Now a scientist called Peter Convey, who's with the British Antarctic Survey, who obviously worked down in Antarctica, they've published a paper in Current Biology showing a form of moss can be brought back to life after being in the permafrost for at least 1,500 years. So they went to a remote part of Antarctica. They put a core into the ground and drew up 138 centimetres through this moss bank, including right down into the permafrost. They carbon dated each of the sections of that moss, so they knew exactly how old each of the bits were. And in the lab, they then, under very pristine conditions, incubated under ideal growth conditions in a nutrient, those moss samples from right at the bottom of the core. And they were very surprised to see moss growing again very soon. Didn't take very long to come back to life. And rather than it being new moss seeded onto this by contamination, they can see the original moss roots and parts of the plant, and or if it's fair to call it a plant, they can see those sprouting to make new growth bodies. So they're very happy that this is actually the original plant, which has been in a state of suspended animation for 1,500 years or so. And why this is important is that it suggests that plants and other species can actually survive and persist for extremely long periods under the ice. They say this could be a new sort of refuge during glacial periods for plants and animals, certain types, because we know bacteria, for instance, can also live for tens of thousands of years frozen in ice like this. And so this is a big step forward, because it's one of the oldest organisms brought back to life in this way without actually having to do anything special to it.
Fabulous. And Chris, you could say the answer's been literally in front of our faces all along, as plain as the nose in our front face. But it's a long time been thought the human nose can only distinguish between 10,000 different smells. Now, scientists in the US say that number could be much higher. How high? How much higher?
It could be a trillion different odours that your nose can discriminate. A trillion, indeed. And it's just an amazing myth that Leslie Vossel from Rockefeller University said to me she can't believe that, you know, since 1927, when this was first published, we've been saying the nose can detect between 6,500 and 10,000 different smells, and that's it. Not true. They've done this wonderful series of experiments. They've published it this week in Science. They took 26 volunteers. They took 128 different smelly chemicals, mixed them together in different combinations of 10, 20 or 30 of them to produce a whole range of different smells, presented them to people in three tubes, two of which were the same combination. The third one was a different combination with a different proportion of the chemicals being the same, a different proportion being different each time, to see if people could discriminate which were the two that were the same, which was the different one. And they found actually that people are remarkably good at doing this, and that the basic maths that they've done to extrapolate shows that within, you know, a few degrees of freedom, you can probably easily discriminate with a human nose about a trillion different smells, which is an amazing thing. We'd overlooked the power of smell, and it means that we're better at smelling things by an order of magnitude than we are at detecting the differences in different colours. We can probably see between 2.5 million and 7.5 million different colours. We're much better at smelling things than we are seeing things, it turns out.
It turns out. Chris, thank you very much. Who knew?
Thanks, Fran.
Dr. Chris Smith, our regular science correspondent, joining us from the UK. And you can hear more from Chris on the Naked Scientists every Friday at 10 p.m. here on RN. And I urge you to listen in. It's fantastic.